ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, as governments search for solutions to gender-based violence, support groups say more help is needed for women and children once they've escaped their abuser. Also, scammers got $2.7 billion out of Australians last year. How can you avoid their traps? And as big music festivals struggle to survive, one organiser thinks smaller events are the way to go.
By actually programming a festival that puts the musicians into some of the existing live music venues, that creates that really great atmosphere. It's a lot less risk than, say, some of the bigger festivals.
On Wednesday, representatives of all Australian governments will meet to urgently consider ways of stopping violence against women. At least 27 women have died so far this year from gender-based violence in Australia, and as we saw at rallies around the country over the weekend, people want action to stop it. Community organisations are calling on National Cabinet to focus on the long-term support of women and children and interventions that are working already. John Daly reports.
Perth-based community organisation RUA has considered domestic violence to be at crisis levels for a long time. In a sign of how overwhelming the problem has become, the service has to turn away many women from its refuges because demand is higher than it can handle.
We would probably turn away in excess of 200 women a year, and again, we're not unique. So it is evident that there is still a strong, there's a crisis need across WA and I suspect across the country.
Deborah Zanella is CEO of RUA. The deaths of 27 women so far this year have prompted public outcry and calls for governments to do more. Ms Zanella says any new policy, plan or penalty won't be a silver bullet alone.
Anything that is sold to say that an ankle bracelet will be the thing that actually ends violence against women does an injustice to the women and children who experience violence. The flip side to that, ankle bracelets do monitor behaviour. I think the reality is we need all of those things. Those things in isolation don't work.
What are some of the things that really work when it comes to getting women out of these, violent situations and not returning to them?
That's a really good question. I don't think we really know what works. Certainly in a refuge service, we work with women while they're in crisis, but we don't do any long-term follow-up. We don't really have a body of evidence that tells us what has been the most effective or what are the key elements.
Deborah Zanella says there needs to be more funding for research on this issue.
I think it's important that we begin to demonstrate through evidence what works, what doesn't work, in order to actually make good investments into the future.
What is known is that one in three women have experienced physical violence after the age of 15. And on average, a woman is killed by an intimate partner every 10 days in Australia. The federal government already has a national plan to end violence against women and children by 2032. Deborah Zanella says healing and recovery and early intervention are pillars of that plan, but they're being neglected.
Prevention is often, and early intervention are harder things to measure. And also because crisis is so real and so raw and the demand is so great, it's difficult. So I would say that, I'd be pretty gobsmacked if any federal or state minister argued that we hadn't really invested as much in those other pillars of the national plan.
RUA will soon launch the Carlup service, which is all about healing and recovery. Service lead Suzanne Blythe says it will stop women and children being left behind after the initial crisis response.
It goes beyond crisis, and when those women and children come through in a crisis setting, the recovery and healing is really about that long-term impact. So supporting those women and children on that journey, because it's not something that is over necessarily as soon as you leave the situation.
On top of therapy and support, the Carlup service will give women safe access to other services like GPs, dentists and financial counsellors. Suzanne Blythe says it's also about early intervention for the children of family violence and making sure they don't repeat patterns of violence when they're older.
Look, I think they need a lot of support, and they probably, it goes under the radar a lot of the time for children. So it's incredibly important in terms of, as we break that cycle into the future so that they don't continue to be victim survivors of domestic violence or become users of violence in the future. So without that support and that service around them, they don't know any different.
National Cabinet will hold an emergency meeting later this week. Deborah Zanella says policymakers need to keep domestic violence at the top of the agenda, even after it's fallen out of the news cycle.
I think one of the things, whoever, you know, currently who is in government, whoever is, you know, future into the future in government, that this issue of violence against women and children remains one of the top priority areas, just like the country coalesced when COVID hit our shores, that this remains on the top of any government agenda for the next 10 to 15 to 20 years. It has to remain as such.
Deborah Zanella is the CEO of Perth organisation RUA. That report from John Daly. Rosalind Dixon is a professor of law at the University of New South Wales. When it comes to finding solutions to the domestic violence crisis, she agrees with the Federal Attorney General that a Royal Commission isn't the best way to go because of the expense and the fact many measures to tackle the problem have already been identified. She's calling for emergency task forces to be set up in every state and territory. Professor Dixon says they should include both experts and survivors of violence to make urgent recommendations on initiatives that could be introduced within months.
What would be the top of my list? Making sure that we recognise the role of mental health in this area and really reinvesting in social workers and psychiatrists, including acute crisis teams who can manage mental health crises, and making sure that those people who are really at risk themselves, but also at risk to the community, are properly supported for their own and the community's sake. So that would be high up there. I think we need to revisit bail laws and refuse bail in certain high-risk matters involving breaches of an AVO or family violence. We need to revisit the balance between offenders and complainants when it comes to bail in family violence matters. I also think we need to look at and really carefully scrutinise the options for GPS monitoring and tracking of high-risk offenders or those subject to an AVO with certain high-risk markers like prior offences, use of a weapon, attempted strangulation, collateral violence against children or pets, things that we know from the data significantly elevate the risk of a breach with devastating consequences.
What do you think can be done to help women leave abusive relationships?
Well, services are very important, and we've seen cuts that need to be reversed, and we need to see significant reinvestment in shelters and social housing that allows people those options. We do have emergency financial grants. We need more of them. Women need proper legal advice, which is why I said that we need to increase funding for community legal centres and legal aid. Women are eligible for emergency finance payments. We need to allow them to be more generous and longer standing, and we can support women with job retraining. But of course, you need the whole picture. You need psychological support, you need legal support, and then you need to be able to financially survive and look after your family. And that means that some of the economic drivers of gender inequality are also ones we should be paying attention to.
Sadly, we often see reports of murders of women where apprehended violence orders are already in place. Can anything be done to make those more effective?
Yes. I think that the problem with those orders is sometimes there are breaches that are not then enforced strictly and leading to really concrete penalties and enforcement. And I think police can be supported and encouraged to treat breaches as a very serious matter warranting prosecution. And more important, to stop those most horrific outcomes, which lead to, you know, death, we need a tracking response which allows us to identify where someone has breached an order and to send out an emergency police response in order to protect women who are at the greatest risk.
Australia's first Royal Commission into Family Violence was in Victoria, and it wrapped up in 2015. The state government says it's implemented all 227 recommendations. Do you think they're making a difference, though, in Victoria?
Yes, I do. I think that Victoria's made progress. Other states have a lot to learn from Victoria, including New South Wales, and they spend more than $200 million a year extra on this issue compared to New South Wales. I think Victoria is the place to start for other states in learning how we can do better. But of course, there are global models and precedents. France, Spain, the United States, they've all experimented in this area. There's a lot to learn, but you don't need a judge with coercive powers or a team of barristers. You need policy-informed experts and those with lived experience on the job right away with a commitment from governments to make real change.
Are there particular things you'd point to in Victoria or perhaps some of those overseas countries that you would point to as being good measures, effective measures?
I've just been, you know, refreshing my memory of some of the overseas tracking models, and they definitely have benefits, although there are better and worse examples. I think we should be looking first and foremost at how we can limit bail and add tracking in addition to fairness and civil rights protections around those measures as a lesson from overseas. And the Victorian experience is you've got to fund the support services both for complainants and alleged perpetrators, because if we don't protect people from, you know, the ravages of intergenerational trauma and mental health challenges, unfortunately, they become a risk not just to themselves but to the community.
Law Professor Roslyn Dixon from the University of New South Wales. Australians lost more than $2.7 billion to scams just last year, according to the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission. The federal government's rolling out a mandatory code designed to prevent and disrupt the dodgy schemes. But as individuals, what can we do to avoid falling victim to financial crimes? Here's Kathleen Ferguson.
For most of us, modern life is pretty busy, and whether we like it or not, we usually make thousands of little decisions each day. Behavioural economist at RMIT University, Dr. Meg Elkins, says making all those decisions forces our brain to cut some corners.
So we tend to use what we call shortcuts or heuristics that help us make decisions. And so sometimes we make good decisions based on these heuristics, but they're not always great decisions.
She says one group of people who understand this better than we realise is scammers, and they are very good at using this tendency to make shortcuts work against us.
Scammers can often come at us at like 2 and 3 in the morning when you might open your text and just randomly click on something that you probably wouldn't do like at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. So they know how to get through some of our filters.
Scammers also use other techniques like pretending to be an authoritative figure, like a bank employee, or making what they are trying to sell us seem scarce by creating a sense of urgency. Behavioural economist Dr. Meg Elkins again.
When people ask us to do something and we perceive that they're an authoritative figure, either from an institution or from the way they're dressed in a uniform, or even someone with a particular orative voice.
Australians lost less money last year than in 2022, and more people are reporting scams, which helps regulators. But we can take steps as individuals to avoid becoming victims. The Australian Securities and Investments Commission says we can stop, think and protect ourselves. ASIC's Commissioner Alan Kirkland explained this slogan to me.
So stop, don't give out personal information or act on investment advice you've come across on social media, and don't feel pressured to invest. Think, ask yourself whether there's something that feels a bit funny about what you've been asked to do or encouraged to do. And protect is the final step we advise, which is acting quickly if something feels a bit wrong, because the faster you can contact your bank and try to stop any payments going, the better chance you've got of getting your money back if indeed you have been scammed.
Hanging up on someone might feel rude, but Alan Kirkland says if you think you're getting scammed over the phone, ending the call straight away is a good thing to do.
Because often what they'll do is get you to hand over small pieces of information, but it all builds up a picture that they can then use to have another conversation with you and convince you to place your confidence in them.
And he says celebrity endorsements for investment opportunities shouldn't be trusted.
There are some common types of ads on social media that we encourage people to look out for and be suspicious of. So celebrity endorsements, there are a number of ads using celebrities like Andrew Forrest or Chris Hemsworth or Sonia Kruger, spruiking investments. Be wary of anything that looks like, they often look like fake, like news stories.
ASIC has taken down thousands of dodgy investment platforms, which has helped reduce losses to scams. Stephanie Tonkin is the CEO of the Consumer Action Law Centre. She says this shows taking action works and that governments and industry can do more.
There is some good news in the report. So losses to scams did reduce by around 13%, and that was due to some big investment in prevention activity by some banks and ASIC in its takedown of investment scam websites. So it shows that prevention and disruption can work. But the figures in the report demonstrate that we have so far to go.
The federal government is introducing a mandatory code with penalties that can be enforced to encourage industry to do more to protect consumers from scams, but it doesn't include reimbursing those who have fallen victim. And behavioural economist Mary Elkins says one of the best things we can remember is that scams can happen to anyone.
Unfortunately, there's this bias that we have of overconfidence. We all think that we're not so gullible, that we won't fall for these scams, that, you know, we're above persuasion and we make good decisions. But I want to say to you that no one is above this.
That's behavioural economist Dr. Meg Elkins, that report from Kathleen Ferguson. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. Just a reminder, you can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, we'll head to the second annual Adelaide Jazz Festival, where organisers think smaller events are the way to go. Educators and parents say new research is needed to understand the rising trend of what's known as school refusal. Last year, more than a third of Australian students in years 1 to 10 were considered chronically absent. That means they missed at least 10% of school days. In tonight's episode of Four Corners, journalist Sasha Ettinger-Epstein investigates why so many children are refusing to go to school. I spoke to her earlier. Sasha, how fast is this problem growing, and I guess what makes it different to the sort of wagging of school we've always known?
Well, it is very different. These children actually really want to go to school. They want to attend with their peers, but they get a massive stress response from the school environment and then they just can't. So the people that, you know, are involved that are suffering this would like it to be reframed as school can't, rather than school refusal, because it's not refusing school. It's literally cannot, the kids cannot go. So it is an increasing phenomenon, and we know it's gotten a lot of visibility, I think, since COVID and the lockdowns. And there was recently a Senate inquiry which really investigated through various testimonies of people going through it and experts and all sorts of representatives what the actual phenomenon is, but there's still no agreed definition and there are not many experts and there's not much research. So I spoke to Associate Professor Glenn Melvin from Deakin Uni, who is one of the only experts in this emerging field.
I sometimes think of it like school refusal is a child waving a big flag. They're saying, I'm not managing, I'm not coping. And for some, their methods of showing their distress can be quite extreme. And I've worked with parents who've had knives pulled on them by their kids, are so desperate, so anxious in the morning to avoid going to school. This isn't isolated kids here and there. It's in every school around Australia.
So it must be a very stressful time for families. What are parents doing about the problem?
Well, often parents get really bad advice from psychologists or other people that don't really understand what is happening to their child. And, you know, they go to great lengths to try and get them to go to school before they really truly understand what the problem is. So this is Alice Richard describing what she used to do to her child before she really understand what school can't is.
In the early days, I would drag her to the classroom door and then her teacher would literally drag her inside and shut the door so she was trapped in there. And I'm talking like a five-year-old child being bodily pulled by a full-grown adult and then separated from their parent with a door that's locked. And that traumatised her so much. Like, I'm ashamed of that. And I didn't know better.
So, Sasha, are there any government departments or other groups coming up with solutions?
I think the education departments in every state and territory are confronted by what to do about it because there are an increasing number of students that are not attending for this reason. So, yeah, there are progressive solutions out there. I think the biggest problem is there is no agreed national definition and there is also no data gathering through attendance codes because the code of school refusal doesn't exist. So it's difficult for departments to really know the volume and also to know what interventions work. So the government, through the Senate inquiry, has suggested doing more research into this, official research. I mean, there's a lot of anecdotal research through, for example, groups like the School Can't Facebook group, which has over 11,500 members. And these parents, I would say, are the experts because they're living it every single day. I mean, the schools that we profiled in the Four Corners piece, sort of specialist programs that are piloting. So, for example, the New South Wales Department of Education started a program in southern Sydney for high school students who have had chronic attendance problems. And they do interest-led learning. They have a flexible campus. They have small class sizes. And when I spoke to the students there, they really felt valued and they felt special and like that the school environment really cared for them. And they were very interested in the work. And they're actually really bright, young, articulate students that have a great future as long as they can just stay connected to their education.
That's journalist Sasha Ettinger Epstein, and you can watch that episode of Four Corners tonight at 8:30 on ABC TV or any time on iView. Scientists say the ocean off southeastern Australia is warming at four times the global average, and they want to know what this means for the species living there. A group of researchers will head out this week on a month-long voyage to try and answer that question by studying the oceans from Hobart to Sydney. Alexandra Humphreys filed this report.
Gary Thompson was on a fishing trip off Tasmania's northeast coast earlier this year when something extremely surprising happened. He'd stopped to set up a pot and he decided that while he was there, he'd try out a new lure. The result was completely unexpected. A 108-kilogram striped marlin took the lure, a rare fish to hook in that area.
It just about killed me. It was very tough work for 25 minutes. Not an easy creature. But yeah, so once I got back to the ramp, there's a few people there, couldn't believe it. I caught it by myself. Mixed emotions. I didn't really like killing fish, but yeah, it's fed a lot of people, so it's a good thing out of, I suppose.
Gary Thompson has been fishing off Tasmania's northeast for decades.
And over the years, I've seen some amazing changes, like big bluefin coming late in the year, late April, May. We had to turn up with 100 kilo plus bluefin, which never used to be through the 90s, but now it's sort of a common event. Tiger sharks, hammerhead sharks. Yeah, it was a kingfish everywhere now. They're sort of in plague proportions where, you know, 25 years ago, you'd see the odd one around Elephant Rock, but now they're everywhere.
Reports of new species in the area have caught the attention of the CSIRO. This week, they'll launch the second of four voyages on the RV Investigator to try to find out how much the area has changed over the past few decades. Rich Little is the chief scientist on board for the Southeast Australian Marine Ecosystem Survey.
The work that we're doing on this survey then is actually to see what has changed in the last 25 years, and to understand why. We're lucky that we have a picture of what the ecosystem was like 25 years ago in the 1990s that was captured by a survey similar to what we're doing now in the 2020s.
They want to find out whether it's climate change or human fishing activities causing change.
We know in the past 25 years that the trend in temperatures in the water have increased quite substantially. And even right now, there's a marine heat wave.
The vessel will travel with a crew of up to 60 people, including 22 scientists, between Hobart and Sydney. Dr. Little points out that changes in the waterways impact what fish end up on the dinner table.
There's a really significant fishery that occurs in the waters from Hobart pretty much right up to Sydney, and that provides fresh fish to the domestic markets, you know, most of the fresh fish to the domestic markets in Melbourne and Sydney.
Research scientist Bruce Deagle will be leading a research project looking at DNA taken from water samples at about 100 different sites to find out what's swimming below.
So we collect a few litres of water, filter that water onto just a piece of filter paper, and essentially we do a COVID test or something very similar to that, where we can identify individual species.
Through the Australian National Fish Collection, the scientists will have a database to match their samples against and find out how the new technology compares with more traditional research methods.
It does provide a view from bacteria all the way up to marine mammals. So we can actually, with one small sample, characterize the whole community. It's also a relatively simple way of characterizing biodiversity. And it's non-destructive, so we don't have to put nets and things like that into the water to catch organisms.
The month-long voyage begins on Wednesday.
Alexandra Humphreys reporting. Well, it's been a difficult year for music festivals with the cancellation of some of the country's biggest events. In New South Wales, the Splendour in the Grass Festival pulled the pin only weeks after announcing Kylie Minogue would be one of the headline acts, while the touring regional event, Groove in the Moo, announced it hadn't sold enough tickets to go ahead. So it's a tough environment for new festivals, but in Adelaide, organisers of a jazz event are hoping they'll succeed. This report from Angus Randall.
A New Orleans-style jazz band winds its way through Adelaide's Rundle Mall shopping strip. It's part of the city's second annual jazz festival, one of the few festivals to launch post-COVID.
People were looking for an opportunity to kind of get out and celebrate and try and reinvigorate our live music ecosystem.
Kaya Bloom is the festival's artistic director. She knew if she was going to put on a show, it had to be low risk, and that meant programming small shows in small venues.
Jazz works really well in quite an intimate environment. So by actually programming a festival that puts the musicians into some of the existing live music venues, that creates that really great atmosphere. It's a lot less risk than, say, some of the bigger festivals where they've got massive infrastructure costs, huge insurance, public liability costs.
Australia's large festivals are continuing to struggle. Multi-day festival Splendour in the Grass cancelled due to what it called unexpected events. Regional one-day event Groove in the Moo was more blunt. It blamed poor ticket sales. And last month, East Coast festival Pandemonium Rocks cut several high-profile bands from the bill in what appeared to be a cost-cutting measure. Kaya Bloom says even for her smaller-scale event, she's still dealing with significant uncertainty.
Costs have ballooned, but we've also got issues with an economic downturn, and it's a lot harder for people to be able to afford to go out, so people are leaving it to the last minute.
After being burnt by COVID cancellations, music lovers are holding off on buying tickets the moment they go on sale. And while some festivals remain a labour of love, the industry has consolidated around a few big operators, like Live Nation, which owns the company behind Splendour in the Grass. Dr. Sam Whiting is a lecturer in creative industries at the University of South Australia.
A lot of these festivals are carrying a lot of debt from the COVID period, and I also think festival promoters have become more risk averse. They're much more business minded when you've got multinationals involved who are just going to pull the plug if they see a loss coming.
He says there's still a market for genre-specific festivals, but the days may be numbered for festivals that try to have something for everyone.
Festivals that cater to kind of a dedicated, maybe niche audience, like metal or jazz or hip-hop or dance, those festivals are still doing quite well. And I think it has a lot to do with the way that we consume music now. It's much more targeted and curated through digital media platforms like Spotify, where the platform's kind of feeding you what it already knows that you want to hear, which means that we kind of, our tastes are much more concentrated than they used to be when we accessed music mainly through radio for young people, Triple J, who took a broad brushstroke approach to programming. And festivals would often follow that programming style. You know, you're kind of offering something for everyone, but not enough for them to make that massive commitment for a multi-day music festival and the price associated.
The reported death of the music festival is nothing new. When the Big Day Out imploded after two decades as the country's biggest summer festival, there were fears others would follow suit. But Dr. Sam Whiting says festivals will find a way.
We worried then about the death of music festival, and I think what we're seeing now is a shift in audience behaviours and consumption, not spelling the death of the music festival, but I think maybe spelling the death of the multi-genre little bit for something for everyone approach to programming. I don't think that's the way we consume music anymore. So I think music festivals are going to become more targeted, more genre specific and more niche. And I certainly think they have a future in that regard.
Dr. Sam Whiting from the University of South Australia, Angus Randall reporting from the Adelaide Jazz Festival. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You'll find all our interviews and reports on the PM webpage, and you can catch the program live or later on the ABC Listen app. That's where you'll find ABC News Daily with Sam Hawley each weekday morning. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. At big rallies on the weekend, women and men came together to say enough is enough. Violence against women must end. But how do we end it? Today, host of Radio National Breakfast and the Party Room podcast, Patricia Karvelis, on what really needs to happen to fix one of the nation's most entrenched problems. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.